It's showtime.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We are off and running with another week of Conversation Radio in this, the last month of 2017. It is, in fact, the 11th day of December, 2017. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live, and that is where you go if you'd like to be part of the Madcap Multimedia, Merry Wacky Zany real-time extravaganza that is The Horn chat room during the hours. To wit, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, when this program is live. Okey-doke. Okey-doke. So if you pick out that free screen name and password, well, you'll be immediately greeted in the chat room by the likes of, Sparky and Steve from Georgia Stan, and more wandering in presently as the program goes on because, well, doggone it, we don't have a tardy bill here.
Hi,
I'm Bob Kincaid. And, of course, like I said, with the beginning of the week, well, today is what do we call this? Alabama Decision Time Eve. Or Alabama's Reputation Eve. Or something. Something like that, okay? Because, of course, the big Senate election that was a real ho-hum sleeper was, it's been on for December 12th for a while, and like I said, it was a sleeper. Now it is the fixation and focus of the nation. And moreover, it is going to be, how to put this best, it's going to be a watershed moment for the evangelical Christianity movement to see if they do, as expected, jump in behind a credibly charged child molester. And that presence, or that function of the evangelical movement, as I call it, is the focus of the first conversation we'll be having this evening, namely with a friend of the program, Dr. Michael Phillips from Texas. You may recall that we talked to Dr. Phillips back as the movement to correct the record, so to speak, unfolded with the removal of monuments to Confederate hatred, racism, and bigotry. Dr. Phillips rejoins us now. Good evening, Dr. Phillips. How are you?
Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm well. I really appreciate you reaching out and wanting to discuss this topic a little bit further. I'm glad to know you're okay after all that you went through in the controversy surrounding the Confederate monuments. You've been watching what's been going on with racists and Klansmen and whatever and what have you in the Alabama race as well, have you not?
I've been following the race with Doug Jones and Roy Moore, and something interesting came up last week with an announcement Trump made, and it was mentioned, the subject being the recognition of Jerusalem as capital of Israel. That actually came up at a rally for Roy Moore, a de facto rally that was held in Florida in Pensacola. There were some comments made that I found very disturbing, and that's what I wanted to talk about today.
Well, do please, which it's hard to talk about this race without confronting something disturbing. What particularly caught your ear?
Well, I mean, the issue of, you know, essentially the Republican Party saying that someone who, as you said, is credibly accused of child molestation, becoming an acceptable candidate because of his, you know, he's going to be a vote for the Republican tax bill, or he's a vote against abortion and issues like that. That's disturbing. But during the rally, if you don't mind, I'll read a quote.
Go ahead.
From a Republican state senator at that rally, and Trump came down to Pensacola, and, you know, of course, he didn't say much about Roy Moore because Trump doesn't like to talk about anything other than Donald Trump, but he, at one point, there was a Republican state senator, Doug Broxson, who was saying this, and this is the quote he made, and this is the topic I want to address tonight. He told the crowd, quote, "Now, I don't know about you, but when I heard about Jerusalem, where the King of Kings, where our soon-coming king is coming back to Jerusalem, is because President Trump declared Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel." Now, what he was addressing was a belief system of a large number of people, and this is the, and I apologize for the term, it's a mouthful, a group of Christians who are obsessed with the end times and believe the Bible is a book of prophecy and that most of the prophecies haven't been fulfilled and that the end of the world is coming soon. These people are called premillennial dispensationalists. I'll define that for the audience later. But they believe that the Israeli control of the city of Jerusalem, Jerusalem as its capital, is a necessary first step towards, first of all, an end of the world, Battle of Armageddon, and then the second coming of Jesus. They think this is foretold and that one step leads to the next. And the disturbing thing is that this is something they anticipate and look forward to. Now, I want to say one thing about before I get into who these people are. A lot of people have said correctly that the capital of Israel really harms the U.S. Position as an arbiter of peace. And they said something that I think is a bit incorrect. They said that this was the end of the peace process, you know, between Palestinians and Israelis. I'm going to say something controversial here. I hope that's okay. But I think the peace
process... We do that here from time to time.
Yes. the peace process has been dead for quite some time. You could argue that it was the peace process, if you define that as a two-state solution, okay? If you define it not as being returning to the status quo before the state of Israel was established, or if you define it as, you know, something in between where there's a two-state solution, that solution has been dead at least since Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by a right-wing Israeli in 1995, and certainly it's been dead since Benjamin Netanyahu became prime minister in 2009. Netanyahu had no interest in a two-state solution. And the Israelis, for quite some time, but certainly under Netanyahu, have step-by-step built settlements that are, you know, you've seen those gerrymander maps of districts that are aimed at, you know,
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, you look at the maps of the settlements in the West Bank, step-by-step, really since, certainly since Menachem Begin and beyond. have rendered any future Palestinian state as a nation side by side with Israel as not viable. There's no way a nation could survive with the kind of borders that would be left with the areas that Arabs still have control. And this is a controversial thing, I'm going to say. Both parties are complicit in this. Both parties have, you know, certainly Jimmy Carter negotiated a peace with Egypt, between Egypt and Israel, that ended the war between Egypt and Israel, but did not address in the end substantially Palestinian issues. The Camp David Accords were supposed to be a step towards that, but the United States has continued, I would argue uncritically, to provide Israelis weapons, money, et cetera, while they've gone on this settlement-building program that left the Palestinians in a state where no possible Palestinian state can actually survive. Economically, they would not be able to travel from one part of their country to the next, and they're facing all kinds of hardships. The occupation is, in fact, still in effect in a way. And so there's no peace process that's been killed because the peace process is dead. However, this is an important symbolic step that says the United States has chosen a particular side in this conflict, and we don't care at all about the Israeli side, or not the Israeli, I mean the Palestinian side. We don't care about that in the least. Now, a lot of that is the reason why both parties have sort of accepted this gradual expansion of settlements in the West Bank is this. In the Democratic Party, you have a Jewish constituency that feels a strong tie to the state of Israel because of the Holocaust and, you know, serious reasons. But nevertheless, they support it. And, you know, there are some people who sympathize with the state of Israel because of the historical circumstances under which the state of Israel was established. So it's Jewish constituents in the Democratic Party. In the Republican Party, there are a group of these people called premillennial dispensationalists who could also be called, and this term has been used, Christian Zionists.
Frankly, I prefer lunatics, but I realize that there is a multiplicity of terminology.
Yeah. Well, but the reason they come to be called that is the so-called Christian Zionists are more adamant and more extreme in their position than some of the original Zionists were. And they believe that the state of Israel is there as part of a prophetic plan from God. And they believe that any peace process, particularly any peace process in which Israelis would give up any land to Palestinians in return for peace, is part of the workings of Satan. And that this is going to set up, you know, this is an evil thing. They reject the peace process entirely. And these premillennial dispensationalists, Christian Zionists, whatever you want to call them, have actually affected the politics within Israel and within the West Bank, because many of them are sponsors of settlements. They financially support settlements, Jewish settlements in the West Bank. They pay for settlers to come from Eastern Europe, where the population, the Jewish population there, has suffered a horrific history of vicious anti-Semitism. And many of those settlers come to Israel, and they are amongst the most right-wing voters in the Israeli polity. They are solidly in favor of Benjamin Netanyahu, and they really helped strengthen a hard line in Israel that Netanyahu's taken. And there are people in, I mean, this is the most right-wing government Israel's ever had. And some of the members of the Israeli prime minister's cabinet are explicitly racist, I would say. I mean, it's not even, it's, yeah, where they're comparing Palestinians and Arabs to dogs, et cetera, et cetera. And this has made the situation worse. It was already awful, but they've made it worse. And their objective is to create a conflict. They believe that it's inevitable that there's going to be a battle at the end of the world, the Battle of Armageddon, that is, you know, the book of Revelation at the end of the Christian New Testament suggests is in a real place, the Valley of Megiddo, which is in northern Israel. They believe that that battle will be a final battle between good and evil, and that that battle would destroy the entire world, and except that Jesus comes back to stop the battle, and then he defeats the forces of someone they call the Antichrist, and then the millennium happens. And the millennium.
And if I may, Dr. Phillips, let's also understand that this is largely a Protestant and fundamentalist belief system.
Yes.
For instance, the guy who founded an organization called QIFI, Citizens United for Israel, is a really great big nasty man by the name of John Hagee down in, I believe, San Antonio.
Talk about him.
Okay.
Yeah, he's in my state. Yeah.
But it is noteworthy that a lot of this stuff is deemed to be outright heretical in more orthodox forms of Christianity. I'm not an apologist for Christianity by any means, but I think we need to establish that this is, and this is my word, this is an evangelical movement.
Well, I mean, this is it's definitely conservative, and as you say, fundamentalist Protestants who've added this one other layer, which is the emphasis, the obsession, in fact, with prophecy. Much of the Bible, they don't concern themselves with the Sermon on the Mount. Issues like that, compassion, mercy to strangers, they overlook that, and they focus almost exclusively on what they see as these unfulfilled prophecies pertaining to the end times. And I'm in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I happen to have grown up in, and now I teach history at the college level in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Dallas is essentially the Athens of the apocalypse, as one friend of mine termed it. This is the center of a multi-billion-dollar Armageddon industry. Books, movies that reach mainstream theaters, but most, being shown in church basements, computer games, pamphlets, whatever. Dallas, Texas played just a major role in popularizing this type of thing, and it's a minority view within the history of Christianity. It is, as you say, a heretical view, but it has had a profound influence, particularly in the 20th century. And if I have time, I'd like to kind of go over briefly what the dispensationalists specifically believe, and then, how it became a big thing in the 20th century.
Let me make abundantly clear, Dr. Phillips, you have all the time that you could possibly want, and possibly more than that. So don't feel like you're curtailed in any sense.
Okay, well, excellent. Well, real quickly, let me define. Okay, so I use that $20 phrase, premillennial dispensationalism. Let me explain what that means. And this is, the group of people we're talking about who really think that it's a matter of faith to back Israel in all cases, no matter what happens in the West Bank, no matter what the Israeli Defense Forces have, no matter what human rights issues, whatever legitimate aspirations Palestinians have. It's your obligation as a Christian to defend all of that. And by the way, their belief system is that millions of Jews are going to die in the future. And the attitude is, well, that's part of the game. If we push for a result that ends in millions of Jewish deaths, that's part of how you get to paradise. So anyway, the dispensationalists believe that the term dispensation refers to what they believe are seven different periods of history. They take the Bible literally. So they believe for instance, the Garden of Eden, that was a real place. So the first dispensation is when Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Eden. Then they sin. The second dispensation is between, after Adam and Eve are forced out of the garden to the flood in the time of Noah, and so on. There's a dispensation from when Moses gets the Ten Commandments to when Jesus comes. So history is divided in these periods called dispensations. They believe we're in the next to the last dispensation, and we're at the end of the sixth dispensation. The last one's the seventh. It's called the church age. And they believe that the Christian church was given a limited number of years to preach the gospel, to save as many souls as can be saved. And then the end times come, and that's the seventh age, okay? So they believe that the stopwatch was set when the state of Israel was established in 1948. That's when the countdown begins to Armageddon. And that was a fulfillment of prophecy that God promised that would happen. And then you'll get to the end of this period, the end of the church age, which they believe. And they've been saying for, you know, in America, at least since the American Revolution, that we're almost at the end of the world. The end of the world is almost about to happen always. And the world consistently fails to end. That's the one thing. I tell my students, you know, the world will end when the sun becomes a red giant, right? But they always believe it's just around the corner. And the fact that it consistently fails to end doesn't shake faith in this particular system of belief for the people who embrace it.
And to be fair, if I could just interject, it didn't shake the early church's faith either. Paul expected to be going any minute and, you know, died in Rome, for all we know.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Jesus is speaking to some of his followers, and he said, some of you here today will be here when you see the Son of Man coming back, when you would see the end of the world. He said that to his followers. Jesus did in the New Testament. So, yeah, this is as old as Christianity, although this obsession is unique, and it never really took hold in the Catholic Church. That's never been a big... I grew up Catholic, and this was not anything we talked about when I was growing up in that faith. But anyway, they believe that at the end of the church age, there's going to be an event called the rapture. And they believe that all the true Christians will be taken up in the clouds by Jesus and the angels, and that they will spend 7 years up in heaven, because there's going to be this terrible period called the tribulation, which is going to be a horrific period in the second half of the that 7 year period. Diseases, plagues, and wars, and millions of people die. Now, the first half of that tribulation, they believe, someone they call the Antichrist, who's the exact opposite of Jesus, will become basically a worldwide dictator. He'll have influence over the whole world. He'll make a peace treaty involving the Israelis.
And in fact, a number of these Christians believe that Barack Obama was that very person.
Oh, the Antichrist? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, they said Franklin Roosevelt was their Antichrist. Some people thought Mussolini was. There's always a modern figure. Saddam Hussein was offered as a nominee. There's always a nominee for that position. And generally speaking, I remember when I was in high school in Garland, which is just north of Dallas, someone made a very passionate argument that Jimmy Carter was the Antichrist. So this goes on and on, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev, whatever. But basically any famous, influential person is the next nominee for the Antichrist. So they believe he's going to rise. He's going to basically forge a peace treaty, and this is important to their worldview, where the Israelis will make peace with their Arab neighbors, and that will last for 3.5 years. They're going to build the temple again, you know, the temple that Solomon built. And I find this strange, you know, being very familiar with modern Judaism, you know, because the purpose of the temple was animal sacrifice, right? I don't see that as a function of modern Judaism, but they believe the temple will be functioning again for 3.5 years. And then at the end of that 3.5 years, this figure they call the Antichrist is going to show up in the temple, and basically he's going to declare himself God and thereby desecrate the temple. And that's when you're going to have this mass persecution of Jews that leads Jews on earth, 144,000, to convert to Christianity. And it's going to lead to persecution that leads to millions of deaths. And then finally, apparently, even though he's dictator of the world. There are other armies. None of this scenario makes sense. It's hopelessly complicated.
And it's complete madness, yes.
Yeah, completely. It's gibberish. But eventually all these armies will gather, like I said, Armageddon. That's when the second coming happens. And that's, you know, and this idea has popped up repeatedly during times of economic crisis, economic anxiety, social anxiety. You know, one of the first big waves of this was a man named William Miller in New York, who led this movement where people were selling their property and they were gathered together in 1843 in October because they were expecting Jesus to come back, and they had robes on, they were waiting to ascend, and it didn't happen. And William Miller said, "Oh, wait a minute. I miscalculated the numbers in the different prophetic books. It'll happen a year later." And they gathered a year later. Again, the second coming failed to happen. And believers called that the great disappointment. But they went on and they founded several Protestant denominations that exist today, including the Jehovah's Witnesses. They descend from that movement. Seventh-day Adventist, several groups sprang from that Millerite movement. And so this has happened before, this obsession, but really Dallas played such an important part. And there's a man who was preacher in Dallas who I think is one of the most important cultural figures, and his ideas are shaping world politics today. And someone, if you're not a fundamentalist Protestant, you probably never heard of him. His name is Cyrus Scofield, and he was a man who was born in Detroit.
I'm looking at a photo of him now.
Yeah, 1843. He ended up moving with a sister. His sister lived in Tennessee. So he moved there right before the Civil War. He's 17 when the Civil War begins, and this is really important to his career. He joins the Confederate Army, and he fights for the Confederates. And then after the war, he marries into this prominent Catholic family, this French Catholic family. And through that connection, he ends up joining the staff of a law firm after he gets a law license with a man, John Ingalls, who becomes a U.S. senator. And because of that, he gets appointed to he wins two terms to the Kansas State Legislature. And then he becomes a U.S. district attorney, and then something happens. And the details are really vague, but apparently he accepted bribes from railroad companies. He apparently stole political contributions that were meant for Ingalls, and he forged signatures. And I've never been able to find documents indicating they actually served prison time, but he did stepped down out of public life. He got a divorce from his Catholic wife, and I think that affects his career later. Apparently, he was an alcoholic, and he recovered later. And he began to hang out with these evangelicals, particularly this guy named James Brooks, who was a dispensationalist. And so he becomes a YMCA secretary in St. Louis, and that's when he gets invited by this tiny church in Dallas, Texas, called basically a Congregationalist church in Dallas. And that's really weird because the Congregationalists are not popular in Dallas because the Congregationalists were abolitionists, right? And Dallas was part of Texas. Texas was part of the Confederacy. And they've got only 17 members. He's not ordained. He doesn't have a degree in theology. They invite him to become a pastor, and he is just a smooth talker. He goes out in the community. He uses his status as a Confederate vet. He wins all kinds of followings. Members of the Dealey family. Do you remember Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy was shot?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it's named after George Dealey, who becomes a publisher of the Dallas Morning News. There's a member of the Dealey family that joins this Congregationalist church, and he begins to call himself Dr. Scofield. I actually, the Congregationalist church he had led is now known as Schofield Memorial Church, and I was the very first historian to ever go into the archives there. And I looked and I asked everyone there, I said, did he get a degree anywhere? And there's no evidence that he ever went to theology school, that he had any doctorate, but boy, he's going to call himself Dr. Schofield. And that becomes his ID in the 1890s. And then what really becomes important is in 1909, he publishes, and again, this is a book, if you're not a fundamentalist Protestant who believes in prophecy, you're not going to know what this is. So he publishes this Bible, this edition of the Bible that uses the King James translation. It's called the Schofield Reference Bible, 1909. And that Bible is filled with footnotes, whereas Dr. Schofield, quote unquote, and the real theologians who are dispensationalists who helped him with the book provide these footnotes. They say, this is what this really means. This is what this, you know, you're talking about a beast with seven, you know, heads and 10 horns. This is what this refers to. This is what the Whore of Babylon is. All this obscure kind of LSD-like imagery in the Book of Revelation.
Oh yeah, there was one of these in my home, and in the Baptist Church library where I grew up.
Yeah, this and it's a big hit, you know, and Schofield. In many ways, in terms of his luckiest people in U.S. history, because his Bible came out at a great time, because it's for his fame, because it's 5 years before World War I. And so this Bible comes out where they're going to say many things about it. End of the world conflict. And then World War I breaks out, where you have all this modern technology, and at the beginning of the war, they're still using Napoleonic era tactics. And so the casualties are horrific, but you have exploding bullets. You have, you know, the machine gun was developed for the American Civil War, but it's improved quite a bit between 1861 and 1914. So you have machine guns, you have the poison gas, you have tanks for the first time, you have airplanes used as weapons. You know, the airplane was only invented 11 years before World War I starts. And so the lethality, you know, more than 35 million casualties, right? And then you have a flu epidemic that kills millions more. And this really does seem like the end of the world, right? And then one of the consequences of World War I, there's a British Foreign Secretary named Arthur Balfour, who is influenced by he believes that the Bible predicts the end of the world. And he's kind of a dispensationalist in some ways. And he really wants the support of Zionists in Europe who are trying to establish a safe haven for Jews in Europe. And he writes the Balfour Declaration, where the British basically commit to taking part of what was the Ottoman Empire, which was ruled by the Turks and controlled Palestine at the beginning of the war, that the British are going to work to create a safe place for Jews in Europe to live. And he's supporting Theodor Herzl and a lot of the Zionist movement at that time. And so, boy, Schofield looks like he's brilliant, right? Because he says this. Now, I want to note that in context, it's not that remarkable. Because he's going to predict in his Bible that the state of Israel is going to be reestablished. It's not that remarkable because you had a very active Zionist movement in Europe, and it's famous in the United States. Beginning in 1882, they began to have a series of migrations of Jews leaving Europe because they're being hounded, they're being murdered in Russia, and the part of Russia that's called Poland today, and et cetera. You know, they've suffered repeated persecution. And so Theodor Herzl and other Zionists have started the Zionist movement to establish a homeland in Palestine. And, you know, you have the first of those migrations in 1882. 35,000 Jews go from Europe to the Middle East between 1882 and 1903. It's called an Aliyah in Hebrew. Then there's a second Aliyah, 1904 to 1914. That brings another 40,000. So this movement is going on, and people are aware of it in the United States. You might be familiar with who Marcus Garvey is. You know Marcus Garvey, the black separatist?
Oh, yeah, yes. In the United States? Yes.
Yeah. he establishes something called the United Negro Improvement Association in 1915. That's in between the first two editions of the Scofield Bible. And Marcus Garvey refers to his movement. He wants African Americans to go back to Africa. And he calls it Black Zionism. This is how famous the Zionist movement is, right? You know, he's using the Zionist movement as a model for African Americans to establish a homeland in Africa. But anyway, so this is pretty remarkable. And Scofield gets credibility because of the violence. People see World War One, and they think they can see how the world can end. And then he gets his Bible. He dies in the 20s, 1921. But his Bible has a renaissance, a huge renaissance, during the Great Depression. It's published by Oxford University Press. And I find that interesting that so credible an institution publishes this kind of Bible, right? But they sell so many copies. It becomes the first million-selling book that Oxford University Press has ever published during the 1930s, during the Great Depression, when people really see a collapse of the world. They're seeing the economic system collapse. They're seeing the rise of Mussolini in the 20s, then Hitler, then Stalin. You have Franco in Spain. You have the Japanese fascist government, and they're militaristic. They're aggressive. And then you have World War II, and boy, this goes, you know, to use modern terms, in a way, it goes viral amongst Protestants. And we know at least 11 million copies of this Bible have been sold worldwide. And the thing that really makes Scofield credible for millions of Americans is in his Bible, he predicts in 1909 that there's going to be a modern state of Israel. He says, this is going to happen. And when the state of Israel is established in 1948, he'll go, wow, look what this guy anticipated. And that really builds the credibility of this whole theology. It doesn't become a big thing until Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I would say, because there's a weapon where people could say, yeah, you know, a war really could kill everyone on the planet, particularly as you have the Cold War. And the United States and Soviet Union eventually are going to be able to wipe out the whole planet in the 1950s. Meanwhile, in Dallas again, there's something called the Dallas Theological Seminary, 1924. It basically teaches Scofield and his Bible as the central text. You know, this is how you understand the Bible. And there's going to be a student who goes to the Dallas Theological Seminary named Hal Lindsey. And he writes a book called The Late Great Planet Earth. Now, I'm guessing you and I, I'm 58, so you're around that age, I'm guessing, right?
I'm soon to be 55.
Okay, all right. Do you remember that book, The Late Great Planet Earth?
I not only remember it, I read it, and the late great planet Earth, and no, really, the planet Earth is late, and I'm not kidding, the planet Earth is long overdue. Yeah, he made an industry out of this insanity.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's like the Planet of the Apes movies, right, which happened at the same time. And, of course, they're apocalyptic, too. But, you know, Scofield was tapping into all this fear of the future because of industrialization, the great income inequality, the weapons, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Lindsey was really onto something culturally. Not theologically, but culturally. The book is published in 1970. And so you had anxiety, you know, is the United States a great power anymore? As they're watching the Vietnam War just drag on and on, you know, there's still three more years of U.S. involvement when that book got published. You had the whole white backlash to the civil rights movement, and whites are beginning to think that somehow, in spite of the continued oppressive nature of racism in America, that somehow white people are the ones who are oppressed now, the sense of persecution that's undeserved. The counterculture gives people anxiety. Feminism, you know, 1973, 3 years after the book, Roe v. Wade is going to happen. You have the beginnings of the gay civil rights movement. All this causes panic in people who are religious conservatives.
Absolutely, and just as a footnote, we might also take at least be cognizant that one of the people who made or helped to make Hal Lindsey a star is none other than that same guy who's sitting up in Branson, Missouri right now hustling bucket pudding in the form of mm-hmm. Jim Baker. You could not turn on the PTL Club without Jim Baker having Hal Lindsey on there prattling on and on about Gog and Magog. And I was raised in this stuff. I mean, and when I say I'm a recovering Southern Baptist, I mean that in the same way that an alcoholic is recovering. You never get completely well.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is, after World War II, really, and I think the explosion of those two atom bombs and then the arms race really fed this sense of imminent demise. And you look at the movies in that era, you know, from the Godzilla movies, you know, all these radioactive monsters to, you know, Planet of the Apes and these other dystopian films, 2001. There's a real sense of doom in the culture. And that tapped into that. And, you know,
this particular variety, if I may observe, it gets its hooks sunk in deep in what we now call the Bible Belt.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And people don't realize this, and I'm going to put quotes around the term nonfiction, but the late great Planet Earth was the number one best-selling book of the 1970s in the nonfiction category. And it is astonishing, and it's very much a product of its time and its original version. He's using hippie type, an imitation of hippie slang. You know, he talks about like the rapture being the ultimate trip. You remember people talking about LSD trips and things like that. And he was trying to tap into what he learned from evangelizing on college campuses. And it was a really accessible book, not a very deep book, but an accessible book. And so it was astonishing. And by 1990, 28 million copies. And like you said, he took that same book and he rewrote it over and over and over again. And then that book, of course, is the foundation for those Left Behind books that sold 60 million copies beginning in 2004, you know, the very first book, 60 million copies. And each installment was a New York Times bestseller. And it's odd because that's not a book that, you know, the broader culture realized was so important, but it was really seriously influencing a lot of people's view of the world, particularly after September 11th, when once again, their timing is good. You know, these people repeatedly benefit with timing, and you have the attacks on September 11th. And what's interesting is Hal Lindsey, when he wrote his book, Arabs are almost invisible. But now all of a sudden, you know, it's the Muslim world fighting the, you know, quote unquote Christian world. And that's the centerpiece. But what is consistent is the idea that the absolute central characters in all of human history are Jews and the Israelis. And the modern state of Israel is the linchpin to everything. And you either stand with Israel and stand with God, or you're for Satan and evil. And you can't possibly sympathize with it. And I mean, I'm a collector of this stuff because I did my book on Dallas, my first book, White Metropolis. And that book talks about Schofield and it talks about Lindsey. And so I become a collector of this material because I'm the way some people go to the Indy 500 to watch cars crash, right? I'm fascinated by this in that way. And the product lines that came out of Left Behind book, where there were children's books in addition to the bestsellers, there were the movies, one series.
Weren't there action figures?
There were action figures, and also there was a computer game where you could be part in the novels. There are a group of people who convert to Christianity after the rapture, and they form what's called the Tribulation Force. And in the computer game, you fight against evil forces like the United Nations, by the way. The United Nations are bad, according to...
I remember that well because it was more than a little bit disturbing when that game came out that the Tribulation Forces, as whom you would fight in the game, some of the people you were supposed to wipe out were identified I think with a pink triangle, oddly enough.
Yeah.
You had to kill the homosexuals for Jesus.
Oh, yeah. Rock stars. There are all kinds of people who are part of the pop culture, and they see all of that. And that's the thing. You know, the dispensationalists are adamantly and unquestioningly and inflexibly pro-Israel, but they're an anti-Arab. That's clear, and anti-Muslim. But they're anti a lot of other things. They're anti-Catholic, as I said. They think the Catholic Church is the, you know, what's referred to in the Book of Revelation, the Whore of Babylon. They believe that, you know, one of the Catholic leaders will later be what's referred to in the Book of Revelation as the false prophet. And it's a feature in a lot of these dispensationalists. In literature, Robert Jeffress, who's head of a...
I was going to ask you about Robert Jeffress, because he's right there in Dallas, and he's probably the most influential Baptist minister in the country today.
Oh, okay, so this is how old I am. There's a guy named W.A. Criswell, who is the pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas, which in Criswell's era became the largest Southern Baptist congregation in America. And please remember, the reason there are Southern Baptists, there's a Southern Baptist convention, is American Baptists split over the slavery issue. And the Southern Baptists were pro-slavery. And, later on, they're pro-segregation. Many Southern Baptists become Klansmen. That's part of the history of the congregation. W.A. Criswell was intensely anti-Catholic, and he published a pamphlet about how religious liberty would die if John Kennedy became president. And I'm always reminded of what Jackie Kennedy said about people paranoid about John Kennedy's Catholicism. If they knew what a bad Catholic he was, they wouldn't care, right? But, you know, they saw that as the end. There was going to be an Inquisition in America, et cetera, et cetera. So that is Criswell in 1980. I was a college student. I was a reporter working for my college newspaper, and there was one of the most important events in American political history in Dallas. It was called the Religion Roundtable, and you had Jerry Falwell there. Pat Robertson was there. You had Phyllis Schlafly, who was anti-equal rights amendment for women. You had W.I. Criswell, and the reason they held it in Dallas was because of Criswell. And Ronald Reagan, as a candidate, who was the nominee of the Republican Party, came there. And he said, I know you can't endorse me, but I endorse you. And he also expressed doubts about the theory of evolution, so on and so forth. That was sort of the wedding ceremony that married evangelical Protestants who had backed Jimmy Carter in 1976 to the Republican Party. And that was really the beginning of, that's when Pat Robertson's forming the Christian Coalition, Falwell's forming the Moral Majority. This is really sort of a linchpin moment. And that's also the moment where the Baptists in 1980, the people who believe in biblical inerrancy, take over the Southern Baptist congregation. That's a critical moment in religious history in America and in the history of the Republican Party. And so Robert Jeffress is the pastor of that church now. And he has been an intense Islamophobe, which is a characteristic of the dispensationalists. Anything that's seen as an enemy of Israel is evil and associated with Satan. He is an adamant supporter of Donald Trump. And, of course, that's the thing. The dispensationalists see secularism as a pathway to the Antichrist. So they oppose secular education. They're pro-voucher. They want Americans going to religious schools. They're against the LGBT community. They're against feminism. The United Nations, they think, is a sign of a one-world government that the Antichrist will lead. And they even are against Israelis who favor peace agreements with the Arabs. So one of the most famous dispensationalists is Pat Robertson, right? 700 Club, Pat Robertson. I remember at one point, Ariel Sharon, who is a prime minister of Israel, he's a 300-pound man, right? Yeah, huge man.
Yeah.
Enormous appetite. unhealthy, and people who covered him just said the man had an eating disorder. He's a heart attack waiting to happen. And at one point, after Sharon had dismantled the settlements, the Israeli settlements in Gaza, he has a stroke, and he's alive for years in a coma after that stroke. And Pat Robertson gets on the 700 Club, and he says that God struck Sharon down, struck him with that stroke, because he said, God commanded the Israelis to not divide my land, and that somehow this was a sign, a divine retribution. And this is one that there's so many paradoxes, so many
That particular incident is somewhat fascinating, Dr. Phillips, because in the aftermath of Pat Robertson's pronouncement, he had been in the final stages of putting together a, for lack of a better term, an amusement park, Jesus Land,
on the
shores of the Sea of Galilee. And when he shot his mouth off about God striking, striking Ariel Sharon down with, I don't know, some chopped liver or something, or some schmaltz, then Israel looked up and went, no, that's far enough. That's too far.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. And I want to talk about that in a second, that there is this very cynical relationship between the right wingers in Israel and the dispensationalists. They are mutually condescending and mutually exploitive, and it's an unfortunate thing. And that's one thing that really I find fascinating is this uncritical support of the state of Israel by these fundamentalists, even though the Zionists who established the state of Israel, economically, their ideology was socialist. Israel's famous for its kibbutzim, the kibbutzes, the communally owned land, and they created a large social welfare state. And in Israel, abortion's legal. Israel allows basically civil unions within their borders.
Everybody in Israel can go to the doctor when they're sick. Even though the people who make that possible, the American people, can't.
Yeah, we fund it. We fund their national health care system. But yes, that they have the very thing they think the same dispensationalists think is horrific and unthinkable. The U.S., we fund in Israel. And then also, by the way, gay marriages in Israel, not in Israel, but gay marriages elsewhere, same-sex marriages in the U.S., in France, whatever. If you go to Israel, those marriages are recognized. And, of course, that would be a sign of the end times if any other nation but Israel committed to these premillennial dispensationalists. So that's one of the real odd things about this relationship. I use the term in my book, White Metropolis. I use the term philo-Semitism, which is the opposite of anti-Semitism. Basically, you are a fan, and I would argue that this kind of philo-Semitism is the flip side of anti-Semitism. It's equally dehumanizing.
It reduces Israel and Israelis to a state of fetish object, doesn't it? And I mean that in the anthropological sense.
No, absolutely. No, it does. It flattens out all differences, atheist Jews, secular Jews, socialist Jews, neoconservative Jews, all of them become one group identity. And they don't see them as real humans. They sort of see them as biblical artifacts. Essentially, the fact that there are still Jews in the world, and there's once again a state of Israel, is taken as proof of the Bible. And it's almost like, finding a pottery shard.
Yeah, pawns in a cosmic chess game. They are there simply because they are necessary set props in the whole second coming scenario. I mean, that's one of the things that disturbs me the most, Doctor. And I've asked the question repeatedly on this program. you know, do it, it's kind of one, it's one of those, it's one, it's either this or the other. Maybe, I don't know, maybe my dichotomy is false. You tell me. But on the one hand, either Israel does not know that they're fooling with a bunch of people whose ultimate ambition is to slaughter them, or they do know and they figure it's all a bunch of hogwash and they'll just take advantage of them and get out of them whatever they can.
No, that's exactly what's going on. Okay, here's the thing. You know, they do see Jews as a means to an end. And that's the cynical relationship I want to talk about. The you have dispensationalists believe that Jews have an incomplete religion because they don't accept Jesus. There is an exception, John Hagee. I want to talk about him. But they believe that if Israel isn't there, the millennium doesn't happen. Now, the Israeli government has actually formed a relationship with the dispensationalists. They court them, even though the Israelis typically see the dispensationalists as rubes, as uneducated fools. However, the dispensationalists organize lavishly. They spend lavishly on Holy Land tours. One of the biggest groups of tourists to Israel are people who want to see not only the scenes of where Jesus lived, but also where the Battle of Armageddon is going to take place and where, you know, this event and prophecy is going to take place, et cetera. They also, of course, these dispensationalists they sponsor Israeli settlements, like I said, and then they lobby hard, and that's where John Hagee came in. You mentioned John Hagee, who's a San Antonio dispensationalist. He has a church called Cornerstone. And he's got his own interesting personal history.
He's a multi-millionaire into the bargain.
Oh, absolutely. You know, he has this church called Cornerstone. He had another church he got kicked out of because he was married and he had an affair with a member of the church and they kicked him out, and then he formed this other church. And he's a very talented saxophonist. It's interesting to watch him perform.
And you know, for anybody who is even remotely interested or might be thinking about Googling John Hagee, now that you know he had an affair, if you Google him and look at his image, it's on you, not Dr. Phillips and me, okay? Because I just had that moment of imagining John Hagee, and not sleep.
The thing is, his politics are what's really disturbing. And I just mentioned the affair because it really illustrates the hypocrisy of the man, because he is so, you know, adamantly anti-LGBT, you know, and same-sex marriage. He thinks that's horrific. You know, of course, one of the Ten Commandments is against adultery. That didn't bother him. And he went on. And I knew someone whose father was a contractor, and they were expanding the parking for the church. And he designed this beautiful outline for the parking lot where there'd be tree cover and they wouldn't knock down as many trees, so the trees would be preserved, but also the cars wouldn't get hot. And John Hagee saw the blueprints and he said, "Trees don't tithe." And so he wanted every tree knocked down to have maximum parking space. It's the kind of person he is. But anyway, Hagee is a dispensationalist. He's written a lot of these, and these people just basically rewrite the same book. They plagiarize each other all the time. And this really does reveal the, I think, rather disturbing attitude. You know, because on the surface, they're philo-Semitic. They're pro-Israel, pro-Jewish. But Hagee made headlines in 2008 because he endorsed John McCain. He always endorses Republicans. And this is a dispensationalist thing. And I should note, I forgot to mention, the dispensationalist movement is a white thing. It is not a black thing. The black church has not endorsed this at all.
You run across a little bit of it amongst the apostolics, but I agree.
It's not really. And the fact is, Scofield encouraged political activism. He said that when Jesus was alive, slavery was at its worst. Inequality was at its worst, but the gospel. And so if you're worried about the world, the environment, whatever. You think that humans can make the world a better place, and you don't believe in God.
And out of that, and out of that even rises what we recognize as dominionism.
Right, right, yeah. And so, what's interesting though is these dispensationalists have sort of, it's like a Venn diagram. They rejected political activism, but then they got active against abortion, against feminism, and pro-Israel, et cetera, et cetera. So they're not very consistent. But the thing with Hagee is, Hagee, you know, and all these dispensationalists tend to endorse Republican candidates. He backed John McCain in 2008, and he was briefed. And then this interview and these sermons became record. He did an interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air on public radio, and there were other interviews and sermons he did where he characterized Hitler, Adolf Hitler, as a hunter sent by God to punish Jews for their sin and to chase them basically out of Europe into Palestine. That was the function of Adolf Hitler, was to get the Jews out of Europe. And the Holocaust, therefore, in this viewpoint, was basically an instrument by God to achieve the end of the world. The fact that
divinely inspired, God is a genocidalist.
Yeah. And therefore, Hitler is an instrument of God. And this is a guy who has a group called Christians United for Israel. And this is a giant lobbying group, and they raise money, and they lobby politicians. And again, I want to emphasize, this is unfortunately a bipartisan thing where basically any critical look at Israeli policies, which I think the policies in the West Bank are dangerous to Israelis. It's, you know, in addition to being horrific for Palestinians, it's not good for anybody. And it's not good for the United States. So it's a hat trick, you know, like in hockey. But anyway, this group has gotten people like Joe Lieberman to speak to them. And Joe Lieberman has nothing but praise to say about John Hagee, because he raises money for Israel, for all kinds of charitable donations, and he pays for the settlements. And they get top-notch, you know, like the former vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party, to speak at their events. And he's still a big influence. He's at towards the end of his years, and like Jerry Falwell, you know, established a monarchy over at that church, Liberty University, with Jerry Falwell Jr. There's a Matthew Hagee who's going to take over that church eventually.
We've run anyway, clips from him here, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So this is really, and the fact is that they're really distorting Israeli politics by bringing in settlers who are far right wing, and they do what they can to make any pretense of a movement towards a two-state solution impossible. And I know many Arabs who frankly feel like a two-state solution is not appropriate, because you know they feel like even Arabs living in the state of Israel, if you define the state of Israel as a Jewish state, that automatically marginalizes Christians living in Israel and also Muslims. And they also say the Jewish state is not just a religion, it's an ethnic identity. Many Muslims see Israel as inherently an ethno-state. And so they don't favor, you know, any kind of resolution that isn't, you know, multi-secular or multi-ethnic, multi-religious, secular entity that's divorced from any concept of Islamic state, Jewish state, whatever. That seems very far-fetched now at this point because of the politics, but so does the two-state solution. And it looks like currently, and with Trump's moves, that we are locked into a one-state solution, which Israel is a state. But I would say this, and I say this as someone who is deeply concerned about anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish violence, that this approach doesn't help Jews anywhere. And I would say also that that we have, you know, basically a future where demographics are going to determine what happens. the Arab population within Israel is going to outnumber the Jewish population. And then the only way you could define Israel as Jewish is if you establish an open theocracy. And, you know, you have a South Africa type state. You know, Jimmy Carter got into all kinds of trouble when he compared Israel to South Africa and apartheid. But that's going to be the only way Israel as a Jewish state can be maintained.
Well, and you've got really creepy overtones under that scenario, Dr. Phillips, of racial purity. And you know that's a movie we've already been to, and it never ends well.
No, you know it's interesting. I mentioned Marcus Garvey, and I'm honestly not. You know, here's the thing: in Israel there is a peace movement, and in the United States there is a group called J Street that is lobbying for a two-state solution. Whatever you think about that, but I would say that. It's interesting that not only Garvey in the 1915 to 1925 with the United Negro Improvement Association, but even Richard Spencer. I believe we talked about Richard Spencer last time. He's from Dallas, right?
We did.
White, yeah. And as anti-Semitic as Richard Spencer is, he points to the modern Israeli state as a model for his idea of a white ethno-state in the United States. And I think that ought to give pause to Israelis who are sincere about their desire to live peacefully with their Arab neighbors. And I think that the dispensationalists tend to reinforce the very harshest elements in Israeli society. And they're not playing a positive role on the world stage. This is dangerous, and it also warps American politics.
Well, it does, and that sort of brings me back around. Oh, just one little trivia point you might get a kick out of, because we are of a similar age. I don't know, 1976, and 1976 is, of course, when as you've described, the politicization of this movement really begins to have its legs start growing under it. By 1980, you'll see the moral majority in full flower, that sort of thing. In 1976, there was a pop song. Like I said, I'm a recovering Southern Baptist. I remember this stuff. There was a pop song in 1976 that spent 2 weeks on the Billboard Hot 100 behind Play That Funky Music. And the name of that song was I'd Really Love to See You Tonight by a duo called England Dan and John Ford Coley.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Okay, so what in the world does this have to do with what Bob and Dr. Phillips are talking about? Well, there's a line in there, and it turns out it's kind of the chorus, and it's, I'm not talking about the moving in, and I don't want to change your life, but there's a warm wind blowing the stars around, and I'd really love to see you tonight, okay? Straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
But this is back in 1976. There's no internet. There's no way to go and immediately look up the lyrics to a song unless they're printed on the inner sleeve of the album. And you don't get that when you buy an 8-track tape, of course. So and this is how Looney Tunes the evangelical movement can get. They decided, Dr. Phillips, that line, I'm not talking about the moving in, was I'm not talking about millennium.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
And suddenly England Dan and John Ford Coley were agents of the Antichrist.
Yes.
Because they rejected the second coming of Christ Jesus. This was a thing. This is how nuts it really, really was. And children, and, well, you know, the Baptists were never crazy about rock and roll in the first place. And if that's rock and roll, well, you know, I'm Genghis Khan. But still, they weren't, you know, if it wasn't in the hymnal, they weren't too crazy about it to begin with. But when they heard that, that was right up there with John Lennon declaring he was bigger. The Beatles were bigger than Jesus.
Oh yeah, yeah. They freaked out about George Harrison's "My Sweet Lord," and because of the Hindu, lyrics. You know, the reference to the Hindu deity.
I mean, we're talking about people who. I'm not trying to be dismissive, Doc.
No, no, I understand.
But they're not screwed down real tight. And they
what
don't.
What I would say is, go ahead.
No, and they, the education they have is the education that they get from the pulpit. And to sort of loop this back around to Alabama and Roy Moore, I guess one of the questions I would ask you is, to what extent do the people who are in these churches know all of what you and I are talking about?
Well, I would say this. I've met some people who are dispensationalists who are articulate and well-educated. I would not necessarily stereotype them. They have an area of focus that is to the exclusion of a lot of other knowledge. And I would think that to a large degree, that this is a reaction, not, based on ignorance, but based on fear. There's a fear of the modern world, and they feel displaced by a multicultural world that involves multi-religions that are not all part of, the Judeo-Christian orbit or even the Abrahamic orbit.
Isn't that sort of fear the kind of thing that gives rise to fundamentalisms of all stripes? I remember in T.E. Lawrence's book, Lawrence of Arabia, his book how he talks about about how Wahhabism, which is a fundamentalism, came into being in Saudi Arabia directly as a result of a rejection of modernity.
Well, and here's the thing. A lot of this, strangely enough, is promoted by people who are privileged and whose privilege has been built on the traditional structures. I think it's a mistake sometimes some people make to think it's all coming from the bottom. I would argue, no, it's not. That this is convenient for people in power, but they're also trying to preserve their power by preserving the status quo. And they don't see themselves remaining in power or in place if the ground shifts underneath them. And so I would not necessarily argue that it's born of ignorance, because these people can have encyclopedic knowledge. There's a man named Jack Van Impe, you know who he is, right? I think he's like a former polka player or something, and he has a show with his wife that's been on for decades. I think he's health-wise, he's unable to do the show anymore, but he's literally got the Bible memorized. It's remarkable how he can rattle off the verses, and some of these people are autodidacts, but they've taught themselves Greek and Hebrew and a non- systematic method. And it's not that they're dumb. It's that they see a threat. They don't know where they fit in a world where power has to be shared so broadly amongst so many different competing social, religious, linguistic, and cultural groups. And the sexuality issues frighten them. So this can be the upper class. And I argued this about Richard Spencer, and I argued this about Trump. The Trump followers are not in the trailer parks to a large degree. Those folks in the trailer parks didn't vote. They stayed at home. They're dispirited. They don't have time to vote. Their boss may not give them time off to vote. They may be working all Tuesday day and then Tuesday night at their second jobs. The Trump voters were $70,000 a year in income or above. And really, if you look at people at some college, Trump won people, the only group he lost in terms of education solidly were graduate students. So I think there's a tendency to attribute social malady to people who are struggling, to the working class, and to the struggling middle class, when a lot of this is manipulated from above. I really do feel that. And I see dispensationalism is not necessarily a product. It's certainly, there's a big, sophisticated industry that's producing these books, producing these movies. They created, I mean, it's remarkable. You know, these people are dangerous. I forgot to mention, you know, there was an incident where, I don't know if you remember, there was a TV and radio evangelist named Gardner Ted Armstrong. Do you remember him?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Worldwide Church of God. And his father, Herbert W. Armstrong, had established basically it was called the Radio Church of God. So this is born in
the media. Yeah, Gardner Ted was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you remember, these were people who had all kinds of cultural aspirations. They established this college. It was called Ambassador College. It was always unaccredited in California. They established a branch college in Australia and in Texas in a place called Big Sandy. And they had a media empire. They established a cultural arts center in Pasadena, California. They got some of the top classical music performers in the world to perform. So these are people who are aspiring for cultural legitimacy. But I think it really illustrates the dangers of this belief system. And it's not because it's coming, you know, I think people have class anxieties about the poor and the working class. This is manipulated from above, but this is an incident I forgot to mention. August 21st, 1969, there was a man who was a member of a follower of the Armstrongs, who actually went into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, right? And many Christians believe Jesus will sit down on, that's the site of the Jewish temple, and that's where Jesus is going to sit down, or mountain nearby, you know, they believe that he's going to set down his foot in Jerusalem when he comes back to the world. That mosque, he went inside and he set fire to it to create an international incident that he thought would lead to the end of the world.
Well, that structure has to get out of the way in order for the new temple to be rebuilt.
The temple to be rebuilt, yeah. So he had to get rid of that for the temple to be rebuilt. And then, it's actually the mountain that Jesus could have set his foot on. But anyway, it's going to be near Jerusalem that the second coming takes place. He wants to enhance that, so he destroys this mosque so the temple can rebuild. And then, this was the international incident. And then you had the famous, another group of dispensationalists we didn't mention from Texas, the Branch Davidians and their confrontation with the federal government. This is so much part of the radical right wing, the militia movement that has been, a feature of American life, actually going back, at least to the 70s and 80s, although, it became famous during the 90s. That has an apocalyptic worldview, and we're going to have to deal with this. And these people are willing to shape events, make events happen, cause the world to end. And I think that's the one thing we need to be alarmed about. And I think Trump fuels this with his talk about immigration, where he presents a gloomy and dangerous view of Muslims and Mexicans coming into the United States, that this is the end of American civilization as we know it. His view of how all these big powers are conspiring to destroy American influence and American prosperity. His script resonates with people who think the end of the world is coming. And here's the contradiction, I think, the paradox inherent in this worldview, that in a lot of ways, they have disdained reformist politics, but they also believe they have an obligation to save as much of the world as possible before it ends. And they believe that they're going to be judged by how good they were as Christians, and part of that is backing godly candidates. And they're willing to look at people like Roy Moore and Donald Trump, and here's the rationale they do to get back to Roy Moore. They compare them to figures in the Bible like David, who was an adulterer and who set up the death of a rival so he can marry his wife, Bathsheba. They compare him to people like Solomon, who are described as sinners in the Bible. And they say God uses some of the most sinful and even depraved people to advance his purposes. And so it's not that they necessarily see Trump or Moore as non-sinners, but they see a flawed humanity as an instrument to fulfill his will. That's how they rationalize it. That's how they make the excuses for it. So if Roy Moore is a child molester, well, God's used terrible people before in the past. And I just
think they run around with bumper stickers on their cars, which I have reminded our friends out here who are part of this community. They run around with bumper stickers on their cars that say, "Not perfect, just forgiven."
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing, right? You know, that's the out. That because, you know, they argue that humans are inherently flawed. So, of course, they do these things. But as long as they pray, they're forgiven, right? And, of course, you know, they believe that that acceptance of Jesus as Savior is, in some ways, a guarantee of salvation. And so, yes, they say we'll sin, but, you know, we made the agreement with God, and we, you know, and the Holy Spirit will generally move us to do the right thing. But, you know, that's one thing that's different with Catholicism, because Catholicism, there is salvation is an ongoing process.
I was going to go there because, you know, in the Roman Catholic tradition, that line in James about faith without works is dead, is taken somewhat considerably more seriously than it is in the Protestant world. But as a result of the Protestant Reformation, Dr. Phillips, you know, the threat of purgatory or of some sort of necessity to work off one's sins was utterly done away with. So that you get the Baptist doctrine now of once saved, always saved. Now, obviously, Roy Moore was saved long before he groped a 14-year-old girl. So he was still saved while he was groping and after he groped.
Now, to be fair, what they would argue, and, you know, it's up to, you know, I'm very secular, so let's make that clear. But what they would probably argue is that kind of behavior would indicate that the conversion experience was not authentic. But they seem to really believe that Roy Moore is saved. And so that's why they attack the accusers. And, you know, because they're trying to rationalize this. But they'll leave it out by saying, even if he is guilty, he's going to save these unborn children. You know, he's going to end abortion. And they're going to say, okay, what's the worst sin? Murdering babies or molesting them? And so it's not a very appealing theological worldview, but I think that's the bargain they made, and one might argue a bargain with the devil if one were religiously inclined, but that's the rationale they'll make. And they'll say the same thing about Trump. Well, maybe he did, you know, he was on tape and he did say he essentially sexually assaulted women. But if he signs anti-abortion legislation, if he protects the state of Israel, and if he makes sure that pulpits, churches can be involved in political life and openly endorse political candidates by eliminating the Johnson Amendment, or if he allows churches to be the dispensers of social services, then that advances the cause of God, even if he's an imperfect vessel. And people like me find that rather distasteful, you know, compromise. But that's how they're rationalizing it, if I understand their argument.
Well, I think you've got it pretty closely. Let me ask you this to sort of bring it down to a numbers level. I did a little bit of informal research today.
Mm-hmm.
Using the Alabama Secretary of State's database, I determined that between 1/3 and 1/2 of all polling places in the state of Alabama are churches. And most of them, I'd say it probably runs 10 to 1, Baptist to Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's also Baptist to AME.
Right.
Do you think that has or will have any potential influence on the outcome?
Oh, I don't see how it couldn't. I think the big impact is to discourage certain people from voting. And, you know, I mean, of course, you know, there's been a massive disenfranchisement effort anyway on the, you know, at the behest of one particular political party. Yeah, I tell my students this. I find it remarkable that, the greatest legacies of the Republican Party post-Civil War are under attack by the Republican Party. So, you know, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, in addition to the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, birthright citizenship, voting rights, et cetera. That these are the great legacies of the party in its early years, and they're dismantling it. And if you have to step into an intensely politicized church to cast your ballot, I think that does create a barrier in addition to, you know, voter ID requirements and all the other restrictions that Alabama, disenfranchisement, because they purge voter rolls, people who have served their time in prison who are disenfranchised permanently, you know, that in some states, all these things, in addition to the location of where the voting booths are, I think, yeah, that has a profound effect and tilts the process along with shorter voting periods too. But anyway, so that's, yeah, I agree with you there totally.
And so with all of the foregoing, do you have your magic eight ball or your crystal ball or anything handy? Do you want to take a run at what happens tomorrow?
Well, I learned a lesson in 2016. I'll go ahead and admit that I was part of the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party in 2016.
That's okay. I was too. It's okay. You're among friends. I was too in the primary. And then when the general came along, I did what my politics had always taught me to do.
Well, and you're in Tennessee, right? So you're
West Virginia.
Are you in Tennessee? Is that where you are?
I'm in West Virginia, but I was born and raised in Alabama. So.
Okay. All right. My dad was from Mobile, but anyway, I was in Texas where I knew, you know, that it was going to be a 10-point gap, and so I went ahead and cast a symbolic protest vote, not because I believed in the protest candidate, but because I thought it would make no difference, and I was trying to send a message to the Democratic Party leadership. So I'll confess that, but I thought Clinton was going to win, and I have to say that if I had been in Michigan or Ohio or Wisconsin, I would have swallowed hard and voted for Clinton, you know, because I felt like that would have made a difference. I just thought it's magical thinking to think that if I vote for a candidate who's going to lose anyway, that changes the national outcome because it's state by state election.
I understand. Anyway. I live in the Trumpiest state in America. Okay, it really is.
Texas is pretty close by. I
cast my vote for Hillary Clinton because where I live, that in itself was a radical act.
Well, no, I totally understand. I totally understand, and I have no criticism of that. I would say this, though. I really anticipated, because of polling, and I used to work for Gallup. And so, you know, polling science has traditionally been very good. It failed spectacularly. And I think that we're seeing, like with the Trump election, and this happened, I think this might be happening with Moore, and I'm afraid of it, but we have something called the Bradley effect. I don't know if you remember, there's a man named Tom Bradley who was mayor of Los Angeles.
Yes.
And he became a candidate for governor, the Democratic candidate for governor. He's African American. And polling consistently showed that Tom Bradley was going to win pretty comfortably. And then he lost. And it was sort of like the Trump election, right? I mean, the polls were unanimous. This is, you know, this is going to be a significant gap. And people are even talking about the Senate flipping because of the coattail effect. I think what happened with Bradley was, and a lot of analysts have figured this out, with Bradley in California, people saw pollsters come up to them, and they were embarrassed to say, I'm not going to vote for the black guy. And subtext to that is, I'm not going to vote for him because he's black. And so they lied to the pollsters to a significant enough degree that the polling was inaccurate. Okay, so that happened there. I think some people were either trying to mess with an institution they hated. They see polling agencies not as scientifically driven corporations that also do work for businesses. They see it as part of the media, and they hate the media. So they want to screw with the media by lying, or they were embarrassed to say they were voting for Trump because they voted maybe with a guilty conscience. I think a lot of people did say, oh my gosh, you know, I know this guy, but I'm so mad at the system. This is a bomb I'm throwing to blow things up. But I want to admit that publicly. And I think there was enough, you know, because the margins in the states that swung from blue to red was small enough that that could make an impact on the electoral map projections. I think that happened. I'm worried that there are people who either out of malice or out of embarrassment are voting for Moore, who might be saying they're voting for Doug Jones because they think that's what the pollster wants. And that's one thing that polling science cannot correct, is when someone taking a poll, person taking the poll, the person who's being asked the questions, when they're dishonest. And I have trouble trusting any of the polls at that point. And I also think that Doug Jones made a calculation at the beginning of his campaign that the key to winning was being as moderate as possible, which I think is a flaw generally in the Democratic Party, that they're looking for what I call the mythical Joe Scarborough moderate or conservative who can be flipped
and running and running as Republican light.
Right, exactly. That's what you do. And I think Moore had some things to run on, you know, this record with the prosecution of the people responsible for the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, et cetera. I think he ran towards what he perceived as the middle or even a little bit to the right, trying to get those white voters. And I think it was a quixotic effort. And I think that he didn't mobilize black voters to the degree he could have. He should have been spending weeks in those black churches. And he should have been spending weeks saying,
well,
okay,
I think early on he was, and I think this applies to the Democratic Party generally in Alabama because it is largely, or has been, largely moribund. At the beginning, Doug Jones was simply another ballot position filler who was, for all intents and purposes, a sacrificial lamb.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right.
But that
here's
the other side of that coin. That primary was the Republican primary was pretty hard fought, Dr. Phillips. And it pitted Mo Brooks, Less Brains versus the strange guy versus more theocracy. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better marketing, you know, arrangement than that primary.
Right, absolutely.
So by the time it came down to Moore versus Strange, then what you get, what results from that, and I have repeatedly mentioned that it sort of flummoxes me that nobody out there in the great big for-profit media have made a point of this. Roy Moore won his party's nomination with, get this, 7.5% of the eligible voters in Alabama. Total turnout for that Republican runoff was 14%. Mm-hmm. Roy Moore won with 7.5%. And at that point in time, I mean, one of the things that's being missed is that he is not a loved man. Now,
he almost lost. lost his last campaign for the Supreme Court, as I recall.
Well, what happened was he actually ran for governor and got thumped.
Okay.
He ran for governor and got thumped, but he has been thrown off the Supreme Court of Alabama not once, but twice, because he cannot bring himself to actually enforce or follow established black letter law.
My sense is he is not beloved by Republicans, except for various, a sect of a sect, that there's a subset of Republicans who adore him because he's a troublemaker, but the Republicans as a whole, I don't think he's loved, and that could be a factor, because I think there might be quite a few Republicans who don't show up.
Well, remember, all of this happens because there's a vacancy created in with the appointment of Jeff Sessions. Robert Bentley, who was soon to resign because a good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christian that he was, he got caught having sex with a woman who was not his traditional family values Christian one man, one woman married wife.
Right.
And in order to get the attorney general who was investigating him off of his back, he appointed that attorney general to fill Sessions' unexpired term. That was Luther Strange. But by the same token, he could just as easily have appointed Roy Moore. So that calculus exists early on, that Roy Moore was not going to be appointed to that position.
No, I don't think anyone's, except for a small base, and I'd be reluctant to, stereotype Alabama based on Roy Moore's career. He has a following, but his electoral results are, not typically overwhelming. He's got opposition within his party, but I think that that could be a factor. I really think what matters in terms of Doug Jones is, does he deliver the black vote? Do African Americans show up? And I would say the postmortem would be, did he make the effort to appeal to them and to address their issues and listen to them? Because if he did, that's the base. That's the Democratic Party base in Alabama, is African Americans. And I think that the party needs to learn this lesson, to take that is the most loyal Democratic Party constituency. And they're the ones that are taken for granted. And the Democratic Party needs to seriously learn, stop chasing after the mythical Republican they think they're going to flip. Don't worry about that person. Go for the people who haven't voted for a long time, and go for African Americans. And those are the most loyal people to the party, because they know the consequences of Republican governance.
And yet I've sat in on campaign strategy seminars in which the consultants, well paid, of course, have said, listen, you've got limited resources. The people that you know are going to vote for you, don't bother with them. Okay? You know you got them. You don't have to spend any effort on them. Maybe send them out a notice a week before the elections. Whatever.
That's self-limiting. And then, of course, they ignore the people who have not traditionally voted, which I think that's a resource that needs to be tapped. And I think that millennials are not recognized. And boy, they don't vote because they don't get an option that excites them and that directly addresses their issues, like the wild cost of going to college now, or the miserable wages and the lack of upward mobility in the United States. That's not a focus. All this talk about the middle class. We need to recalibrate, think about, that middle class is shrinking, so maybe we need to talk about people who are trying to get into the middle class or not drop out. So, this will raise some interesting questions. So the key will be, do African Americans feel like they have a stake in showing up to vote for Doug Jones, who I'm not saying he's taken them for granted, but he has not exactly excited them yet as a candidate, or will that be outweighed by Republicans who are embarrassed enough by Roy Moore that they don't necessarily vote for Jones, but they stay at home. And I think that's, you know, particularly a December election, who votes in December, right? So
yeah, this was originally a sleeper. And if Republicans right. stay home the way they stayed home for that runoff, Doug Jones's chances increased dramatically. Now, over the weekend, Doug Jones, he and the National Democratic Party brought out some fairly heavy hitters: John Lewis, Cory Booker,
right.
Deval
right.
Patrick.
Right.
And in fact, there was a press conference right in front of the 16th Street Baptist Church.
Yeah.
So the effort, the effort's being made.
Yeah, I think that the Democrats really need to, you know, I think the sense of economic dread is what, you know, people don't want to say this. They want to say it's all racism and misogyny. A gigantic part of the Trump base is motivated by fears of the other. But I also say that, again, the calculus always is who voted for Trump or who voted for Clinton, and there's that vast number of people who didn't vote. And that's where you get the votes that are going to win you the elections. How do you get them to vote? And I think it's interesting in the elections in Virginia, right next to you, you know, we had a Marine who's a Democratic Socialist of America candidate. We had 13 Democratic Socialists of America win offices across the country. We had transgender candidates win. We had people who are not part of that party establishment. And Doug Jones, I mean, he shows many ways. He's a very honorable person. But they need to get candidates who excite and get – they need to recruit people who are not part of the process. I really think fundamentally that's the best strategy because both parties are held in utter disdain now. And Trump is extremely unpopular. But the Democratic Party itself is unpopular, and so that's how you turn it around, is by completely and that's what I'm looking forward to. That hasn't happened in Alabama. We have essentially a moderate running against a reactionary, and so that's the dynamic, and we'll see how that goes. I think it is a measure. I think that even in Alabama, deep red Alabama, Trump is a drag on the ticket, and it's fascinating that in Pensacola, which certainly is the part of Florida that's most like Alabama, Trump couldn't fill that arena. And I think that's significant. I think he has lost part
right.
of that.
We call Pensacola Lower Alabama. It's all part of the Redneck Riviera.
Right, right.
And you mentioned
right,
your dad
right.
being born in Mobile. It's interesting that effort has been focused in South Alabama, because in many ways I think you can argue that South Alabama is more friendly to Moore's politics than parts of North Alabama are. Although I don't think it's a blanket statement. The other wrinkle that's in all of this, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out vis-a-vis what happened in Virginia, is the women's vote, because even with the Access Hollywood tape. Well media saturated, 53% of white women still went out there and said, I want the guy that grabs women, you know, and voted for Trump. Will white women do the same thing over a pretty well documented child abuser?
I wouldn't assume they won't. You know, I hate to be pessimistic about that, but in Alabama in particular, the abortion politics are really significant, and white women as a voting bloc have proven to be fairly conservative. And I thought that was one of the flaws with the Democratic nominating process, that they, you know, the I'm with her approach. Women of color, yeah, you can get those votes, and they will support you. But the assumption that suburban white voters, you know, what they used to call the soccer moms in the 90s, they're actually a pretty conservative bunch, and I would not necessarily pin my hopes on them in this election. I really think what will matter most is the black vote.
And they are different. They are different from the white woman vote of, say, Northern Virginia.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and I really think that that'll make or break Doug Jones. And I think that the African-American community, if there's a credible message, and one defect of Bernie Sanders' campaign, and there were a few, was that he did a woeful job in establishing a connection with the African-American community. They did not relate to him. And I think that that'll be the interesting thing, because I think the economic message is the message of the future for the party. People don't want to acknowledge that. The Democratic Party establishment doesn't want to acknowledge it, because it'll force a painful decision regarding who gives money to the Democratic Party and if you accept it. And, you know, that relationship, it's a Faustian bargain. And the Democratic Party is at its weakest position with that funding that they get, that they've been in since the 1920s. Just looking at the long-term prospects, it's been the party. It's not, you know, people want to talk about the Russians and they want to talk about Comey. But the fact is, the party has been declining since 1992. That election, they had control of all three branches of government, the upper chamber, lower chamber of the Congress and the presidency. They didn't have the Supreme Court. But in 94, that's when the Republicans took over Congress. And there have been basically 4 years since then that Democrats have controlled the Congress. And state legislatures, governors, that's dominated by Republicans. Whatever the Russians did in 2016 is, I would say, only part of a very long-term story of Democratic Party decline that has nothing to do with Russians. It has to do with the party's attitude towards economic policy and its lack of an exciting vision.
Right, and it also goes back to what LBJ said when he signed the Civil Rights Act: we have lost the South for a generation. Well, it turns out he was right, but it was more than a generation.
It was a couple of generations. Here's the thing that gives me hope. And this is straying from the dispensationalist argument, but here's the thing.
We do that here. It's okay.
Those southern states were the center, and the term has been maligned quite a bit in recent years because it's come to be associated with people like Trump. But the original populist party had flaws in the 1890s, but it was biracial.
Yes, it absolutely was.
There was a Southern Farmers Alliance and there was a Colored Farmers Alliance. They wanted to democratize the process. They wanted direct election of senators. They were calling for nationalizing industries that were exploiting people, like the railroad industry, the telegraph lines, et cetera, et cetera. They wanted to end prison labor. And it's unfortunate. It was Richard Hofstadter, the historian who I think really maligned the original populist, and it's kind of that image is stuck in the media. Refer any time a fascist runs, they call them a populist. But I think the capitalism has not worked for people under 40. Their entire lives have been spent watching their parents suffer as they get older and seeing their own career prospects shrink and vanish.
Well, I mean, multi-generationally, Dr. Phillips, there are whole swaths of America for whom capitalism has not worked. I live in a place where capitalism worked for a handful of out-of-state and out-of-country investors and millionaires and billionaires. But it sent over the last 100 years 100,000 West Virginians to their graves. You can say the same thing about North Alabama, where I was born and raised. The people of Northwest Alabama were beset, among other things, by almost annual plagues of yellow fever until the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was not a capitalist enterprise, came along.
Right. No. Absolutely. No. You're correct. You're correct. So there have been multiple generations. I think that, you had that anomalous period because to a certain extent because of the New Deal that leveled out those differences, made the game more fair, redistributed wealth downwards. None of the neoliberal projects since the early 1990s has produced that. In fact, it's produced a shrinking middle class and job insecurity, and that's where the issues is. You know, if you want to call it a new deal or something, I don't know what the term is, but you know, the Democrats came up with something called a better deal.
Yeah, that was lame.
But I mean, that's where the electoral, that's where you build the coalition now, because I teach college students and their optimism about their future is at a low point, and they're disgusted by both parties. And one party, my college students, I'm in the deep red county, Collin County, Plano, Texas, you know, near Dallas, just north of Dallas, one of the most Republican places on earth. And these kids come to my college and they can't stand either party. And their critiques of both parties are valid. And it's, you know, because, again, middle class, but that's the only class that exists. And they're forgetting that that's becoming a fantasy, that status, middle class status. And even the middle class is terrified. They're one layoff away. They're one serious illness away from dropping out of the middle class.
They're one ruined transmission away. You know, they're one big car repair away. Since we've kind of run far afield, let me ask you a couple of questions as well.
Yeah.
You being a Texan, mm-hmm. why is Blake Farenthold still in the Congress? Why has he not resigned? Are Texas Republicans the same way? Is it the same thing we were talking about with the premillennial dispensationalists? Is it a matter of so he harassed somebody $84,000 worth, but he's voting the way we want him to?
There is no state that has been so repeatedly gerrymandered than Texas. I mean, when you had unified Texas government under George W. Bush, and then, you know, continuing through Rick Perry and now Greg Abbott, they've redrawn these boundaries repeatedly. They have African Americans and Latinos concentrated into, you know, districts where essentially it's almost all black or all brown. And what that's done is it's guaranteed, and this happens in the legislature, this one, the sinister deals that's made that I think harms African Americans and Latinos, is that the politicians make in the Democratic Party bargain with the Republican Party leadership, where they will be guaranteed seats in the legislature by having, you know, having super majorities in certain legislative districts that are black or Latino. And in return, sometimes they support when the election comes up for Speaker of the House or for, they'll support them. And they agree to these boundaries. And so without those votes, Democrats have a real hard time in other districts prevailing.
This just absolutely flummoxed me, because it was interesting that on the same day that Kirsten Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer and Kamala Harris Al Franken out of the Senate, what I said earlier is they climbed up to the moral high ground they thought they had just claimed. And lo and behold, they found Paul Ryan standing there with Trent Frank's head spitted on a pike. And he acted promptly with regard to Trent Frank's, but with regard to Joe Barton, and I'm sure you saw the photograph.
I tried to stay off the internet for days to avoid it, but you couldn't avoid it.
Well, I have our mutual friend Carol Baker to thank for that.
But I saw it, and
he was permitted to say, I've decided it's time for me to retire at the end of my term, but his vote remains available and reliable until January 2019. Blake Farenthold was such a drunk that his staff referred to him going to parties as having to go on redhead patrol. And he's still there.
You Well, you know, actually what's weird is he's related to a woman who is very important in Texas politics, Sissy Farenthold, who is one of the, who ran for governor as a Democrat. And she's associated with, you know, what passes for progressives and the Democratic Party. But it's the gerrymandered. Blake Farenthold will, I think, undoubtedly face a primary challenger within the Republican Party. And that's how his tenure will end. I think he will be able to make it, unfortunately, because he's not seen as – Barton is more significant in terms of his committee assignments. He's more connected to the party establishment, and so he's more of an embarrassment. Farenthold is really – he's on TV a lot, strangely, or he was before the scandal. But I think he's been a marginal player. He's a backbencher, and I think that's actually worked to his advantage. So, you know, he's been able to survive. They may force him to resign. I'm pretty sure in 2018 he'll lose the primary because people will be embarrassed by him. It's not like he's been a leader on any issue that, quote-unquote values voters care about. And they'll find probably some business Republican to replace him.
And he's out of what, Corpus Christi?
Yeah, that area. Yeah, I mean, it's – and again, these districts, I mean – I remember when I lived in a town south of Austin called Bastrop, and they had the district so gerrymandered that my congressman, that's in the center part of Texas, my congressman was on the coast of Texas. It was Ron Paul. I had Ron Paul as a congressman when I was living right next to Austin. And Bastrop was a yellow dog Democrat, as they say in Texas. And that county was yellow dog Democrat. Austin was the center of liberalism in Texas. And we were stuck with a libertarian, quote-unquote libertarian, as our congressman. So the Republicans in Texas have been playing this game for a very long time and are very effective. And, in fact, it will mean that even after the census is done in 2020, that'll be at least 2 years before anything changes in this state. So the 2024 election will be the first time there'll be any possibility of a Democrat carrying Texas, I believe.
I've said something similar with regard to the House of Representatives on a national basis. Let me ask you a couple of questions before we go, because you've been very generous with your time so far, Dr. Phillips. Are there any developments, any further developments? It seems like all of a sudden we no longer hear about the Confederate monuments issue anymore. Is there any movement along those lines?
We're going to be working on it again. The momentum law, it just dissipated completely in Dallas. You know, we got a statue of Robert E. Lee taken down. And there was something called Lee Park. And the name was scrubbed, and so the site no longer says Lee Park. It's called, it's back to its original name, Oaklawn Park. You have, however, at the same site, a duplicate plantation that's based on Robert E. Lee's plantation called Arlington House, and that name's still in place. We still have this 60-foot Confederate War Memorial that has Lee and Stonewall Jackson and Albert Sidney Johnson and, the figures that's right near the Dallas Convention Center. We still have a street named after a man named William Cabell, who was a mayor of Dallas, who actually participated in a massacre of surrendered Union soldiers who were black in Poison Spring, Arkansas, and his men actually held a contest where they saw how many could crush the most heads of these black prisoners of war with their wagon wheels. He's got a street named after him in Dallas. Now, they're going to change the name of Cabell Elementary School. That change, 4 Dallas schools are going to have Confederate names taken off. But the momentum dissipated after Charlottesville. The real move that... And what happened was we had a very cynical mayor who didn't want to look like he was doing nothing. And he set up this laborious process where he set up this commission to study Confederate monuments in Dallas, make recommendations. The city got the recommendations, and then he said, well, let's have the city manager look, and that's where it is now. The city manager seems to be taking no time. So we're going to have to pick this up again, and we're going to fight when I'm done grading for the semester. That's what I'm doing when I'm not on radio.
You're in professorial hell right now. I know it because
It's the end of the semester. I will be resuming my work on that, and we will have a group of activists who are going to be meeting with the city manager to try to get the issue moving again, and we're going to have some protests in Dallas in the spring, and we're going to force Mike Rawlings, who's the mayor of Dallas, to make good on implied promise. You know, he said that these Confederate memorials were dangerous totems, but apparently he's comfortable leaving these dangerous totems in place, you know, like sticks of dynamite. And it's got to, you know, we're going to have an NRA convention in Dallas.
Oh, what fun.
And, yeah, you know, with these, you know, and of course, the gun rights people have been some of the most vociferous pro-memorial people, so Confederate monuments people. So this could make, you know, this could be a shrine they gather at. And so we've got to worry about that very deeply. And, you know, we're going to try to make that argument that we don't want Dallas to be another Charlottesville. And I think there's a real potential for that.
Well, a month ago, I was up doing some work, some of the work that I do outside radio, regarding mountaintop removal coal extraction here in West Virginia.
Right.
We had to go and pick up a professor who was flying in to speak at a congressional briefing we had arranged. And in driving to pick him up, I found myself at the intersection, and we're talking about U.S. Highway 1 here, okay? I mean, that's its designation. And in Northern Virginia, that is Jefferson Davis Highway. A stone's throw away from the capital of the United States. And
Right. You
may find it difficult to believe, but I actually thought of the conversation you and I had had when I looked up and I saw that street sign, and I thought, son of a gun! Really?
Right.
I wonder. I wonder what it would take to get that hateful name, and I mean that hateful name, off of the U.S. Highway 1 in Northern Virginia, which is supposed to be the civilized part of Virginia.
Right. But of course, that was the epicenter. You know, that's where the Confederate capital was, and that's, you know. So yeah, it's horrific. You know, and they're all over the country still, and momentum was lost. But you know, you build a grassroots campaign. I think it was really the state next to you, Virginia. Ed Gillespie was running on Confederate monuments, basically, and he lost. That did not get him the governorship. And in Dallas, the pro-Confederate monument people were campaigning against a bond issue because they said, oh, look at all the money that was spent removing the Lee statue. They lost. The bond issue passed. So there's no cowardly excuse left for these politicians to not tackle this. This isn't a winning issue for the other side. And, you know, you can move on this, and this is a necessary step towards racial reconciliation and promoting an honest, truthful version of history that actually educates people. When we removed the Lee statue, Dallas talked about what these monuments meant in a way they had never honestly talked about it before. There was a lot of backlash. I got a death threat. You know, we talked about that last time. But it was worth that. And so we need to start the conversation again. None of this is, you know, I think maybe I was one of the people who underestimated how difficult this process is, but it's not over. We're fighting for this, and we're not done with it. And we're going to tie it to issues of poverty and issues of unemployment in South Dallas, which is, you know, where African-Americans and Latinos in very large percentages live. And we're going to say that a city that lionizes slave owners as heroes in a city that will not care about black or brown infant mortality. It will not be a city that will care about poorly equipped public schools in South Dallas. It will not care about the state of roads in South Dallas. it's a city that says black lives don't matter. And in fact, we make heroes out of the people who reduce black people to property. You do one in pursuit of addressing these other issues. The two things are tied.
Well, I certainly wish you the best going forward in all of your endeavors. And, you know, happy exam grading season. You do not have my envy in that regard. Let me ask you one last thing before we go. You've referenced one of your books. If people want to read what you have committed to print, how can they go about doing that?
Okay, so my the biggest work I did, the one that's had the most influence, is called White Metropolis: Race, Ethnicity, and Religion in Dallas, 1841 to 2001. We talked quite a bit about Cyrus Schofield, who we talked about earlier in the conversation. We talk about Hal Lindsey in that book, but it's mostly about how white identity was created in Dallas and how that poisoned the city's history. So that's the primary work. That's the one that won an award, and you know, it's what I'm best remembered for. There's a book I wrote where I wrote. Contributed an essay, and it's called The Texas Right, and it was edited by two of my colleagues at my college. It was co-edited by two of my colleagues, Kyle Wilkerson and David Kalane. So The Texas Right, there's a series of fascinating essays about the origins of the modern right wing in Texas. So if you want to understand the state, which you know really is shaping the nation as a whole, I would go to that book. I have an essay in there about race in Texas in the period between 1880 and 1930. That book is, I think, going to be an eye-opener to many people who read it. So those are a couple of books I'd recommend, definitely.
Well, thank you very kindly, and I hope folks will go and get the books and read them. And in the meantime, I hope you will feel comfortable reaching out anytime that you've got feel like you've got something to say. And again, I wish you the happiest of holiday seasons. Yes.
One last thing. When you buy it, try to buy it at your local bookstore. And if there's a locally owned bookstore, try to do that. Of course, it's available online, but I like to promote local business and also resist monopoly capitalism. So please try to do that. But anyway, there you go.
All right, will do. And just had a note from Carol Baker. She said, by the way, in case Roy Moore wins, they're putting safeguards in place for teenage Senate pages to keep them safe from statutory Roy. I'm watching Cory Booker talk about it on Chris Hayes right now. I don't think that was a joke.
No, that happened. That happened. You know, we know there was a page scandal earlier, a couple of decades ago. So, yeah, this is a terrifying and a sad thing, and it really does show the extent to which women have been dehumanized. And, we have to take the Me Too movement. Unfortunately, I think there's already a backlash to that, and I want that to stop, and I really do want us to do what we've not done historically, which is to take women seriously when they tell these stories. Because we've done that with African Americans. We've not taken their history seriously, or the history of slavery and Jim Crow, et cetera. So this could be a signal moment. They could also be a disillusioning moment. We make the choice.
Indeed, indeed. Dr. Michael Phillips, thank you very, very kindly, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you. Take care.
Have a great evening. Bye now. I don't think you're going to get exhaustive explanations of sociocultural phenomenon like what you just got from Dr. Michael Phillips there in many, many other locations. And so I thank him profoundly for that generous sharing of his time that we've had over the last 2 hours or so. We're going to take a break because there's stuff to get to. This is Morin Monday on the Horn, of course. And we have Morans. In particular, we have a Morin. And I think we really need to deal with it. I'm also going to do some audio experimentation in the next hour. I didn't want to do it with a guest on the line. I have hooked up a different sort of microphone
just to see how it sounds or if it becomes useful, because it's part of a larger plan. Before we go to break, however, thanks are in order. The great thanks indeed. And they go out to our subscribers over the weekend. Christopher in Oregon, thanks go out to Mary Bell in Kansas. To Sylvia in California. To John in Maryland. To Brendan in Oregon. And to Tony out in California. It goes on. Just a minute. We have to do this because it's important that we thank our subscribers, because they're a big part of how we stay on the air here. Alex in Kentucky, thank you very kindly. Jay Joshua in Michigan, thank you. Don, with us for a very long time, thank you, Don. Thank you to Judy in New York. These are our subscribers over the weekend who keep things working. Thank you to Kathleen in Minnesota. Thank you to Brother Deacon Gerald. And thank you to Khalil in Texas. Thanks to Nancy in Virginia. To Tom in PA. Dwayne, also in PA. Thank you, Dwayne. And thank you to Marcia in Oregon. These are all the people who made the following possible. The fact that we come into this program this evening, not without, we finished up with the deficit from last Friday, got completely caught up, and tonight, in what remains of the program, the remaining 45 minutes or so, we only need to raise $110. And that is huge. So thank you to our subscribers. If you would like to become a regular monthly subscriber, you know, where you get to set it and forget it, well, you could just go over to headonradionetwork.com and click the little box on the Contribute tab that says Make This a Recurring Monthly Donation. Mr. Soros, we'll need at least six digits from you, please. Otherwise, you know, what we're ultimately going for is 400 $10 a month subscribers. We're a long way from that, a very long way indeed. Also, if you absolutely despise PayPal, there is Patreon, patreon.com, patreon.com/Bob Kincaid, and you can use... You can use that. If you just want to help out this evening and you don't want to do the subscription thing, well, put in whatever number you want there. Don't check the box at PayPal, and we'll knock down the $110 as best we can. So thank you. Thank you one and all for making independent progressive conversation radio a continuing reality. Thank you very, very much indeed. And by the way, if you're just not quite feeling up to snuff as we head toward the solstice, you know, the solstice is the darkest day of the year, the least amount of sunlight. It starts getting better after the solstice, just remember. But these last few days before we get down there are, they can be kind of tough. And that's why I'm proud to announce from the hardworking peripatetic scientists at Horn Nutraceuticals, Arable Arrowroot. That's right. Arable Arrowroot will make you feel just starched out straight, and keep everything pulled together and gathered in and pressed down and shaken together, just like you want to be at the holiday season. That's right. Arable Arrowroot from Horn Nutraceuticals. It's a proprietary blend of arrowroot non-GMO, organic, gluten-free, cruelty-free, cage-free, free-range, vegan, all put together into a little tiny capsule that for the low, low price for a three-month supply of only $108.64 can provide you with all the arrowroot goodness you could possibly need on any given day. Arable arrowroot from Horn Labs. You know, Horn Nutraceuticals products, when you order that three-month supply, you'll get a little bundle of test strips so that you, in the privacy and convenience of your own home, can find out what we already know at Horn Nutraceuticals, that there is absolutely no nutritional value in any of the bullshit nutritional supplements that we hustle for you here at Horn Nutraceuticals. Arable arrowroot, I've never cared much for arrowroot, but with arable arrowroot, well, I don't have to worry about that anymore. Arable arrowroot, accept no substitutes, post no bills, use no hooks. This side up, FOB, COD, WPA. Arable arrowroot, only from Horn Nutraceuticals. And with that having been said, yes, we're going to take a break. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be right back.
Calling Paris. Come in, London. Come in, New York. Hello, Rio. The bad news is the world is ending. The good news is there's a party, but you better get here quick.
When you feel like a written-off actor on Deadwood, about to get fed to the pigs. When that preacher's bus from hell, blasting just cowbell, parks itself in front of your gig. There's a place you can go called Tierra del Fuego. Down in the southern hemisphere, it's kind of Troy without Helen past the Straits of Magellan. And things are always looking up down here. Cause there's a party at the end of the world.
End of the world.
Where the locals do the tango twirl. Forget the temples in Nepal. Cancel the Fed in Montreal. There's a party at the end of the world. Like I've run out of reasons to be here, so I'm just gonna steal from myself. If your attitude's appalling, there's a latitude that's calling. Get yourself past that continental shelf. Now the band that we hired is playing quite inspired, singing Eskimos and eunuchs from Bangkok. And the location's so nice, we'll never run out of ice, cause Antarctica is just around the block. There's a party at the end of the world,
end of the world.
Where the locals do that tango twirl. Now don't make that big mistake and wind up with Miss Jamaica. There's a party at the end of the world. Flying machines, yellow submarines, French girls and cowboy decor, decor. RSVP is the needed, you see, and they'll all just be screaming for more. I'm more, I'm more. Haven't heard, things are getting quite absurd. Nothing really shocks us, that's for sure. Roadside bombers and tsunamis, oh God, how I miss those commies. No one seems to play fair anymore. But I've spoken to the yogis, had some meetings with my roadies, who assure me the arrangements are complete. Just below the roaring 40s, I am gonna fly some sorties. You'd best arrange that cherished window seat. The party at the end of the world.
End of the world.
Where the locals do the tango twirl.
Tango twirl.
I don't care about the rapture when there's native girls to capture. There's a party at the end of the world. Who cares if there's no fire? We'll be rocking in a schwire. That's a party at the end.
party at the end of the world.
Seemed sort of fitting, at least to me. 22 minutes past the hour on this Moran Monday on the horn. And like I said, if Haley's listening, Haley knows where I'm going. Wow, do I have a Moran for you. It published over at Medium by a woman by the name of Alex. Or a person by the name of Alex, who identifies herself as Alabamian North Alabama Democratic Socialists of America. She published this at Medium, presumably intending to have it, you know, read by people, and people did, and people then read it, and found her to be an idiot of monumental proportions. Or as we say here on Mondays, a moron. So I'm trying a different microphone. You may or may not like it. You're free to say what you think or what you don't think. I spent the weekend tweaking it to see how it would work out, because it could be the front end of kind of an expansion of what we're able to do here. That's a little bit better. I think it needed a little gain. You never know these things until you use them, because it's kind of hard to EQ this stuff and until you've got an actual broadcast environment in which to check it. But so far, I'm fairly pleased with it. It looks about halfway decent. So we will continue. We will continue in this vein unless there's a reason to not. But anyway, this piece is published over at... Oh, this is so cool. I can just push the microphone, the boom microphone out of the way. Sit back, put my hands behind my head, lean back, be relaxed, not lean over on the bad shoulder, which is a bad habit of mine during the program, and talk. So this person, Alex, over at Medium, published, "Doug Jones is a terrible candidate, a critique of Doug Jones from the left." Okay, that's a little bit hot. She writes, "Alabama's special Senate election will take place in just a few days, and to many around the country, the choice seems particularly clear." Now remember, this is one of those sparkle pony types. Oh, that is very nice. Just had some high praise from Dr. Phillips, with whom we just spoke. Bob does his homework, asks great questions, and chips in amazing information himself. Please share my words with him. I respect him a lot. That was very nice. Very nice indeed. And the admiration is a two-way street. Oh, okay, so back to our Moran. There was no way I was going to let Alex get through Moran Monday without a thorough and fair hearing. The Republican candidate Roy Moore has been accused by multiple women of unwanted sexual advances and sexual assault, including yada, yada, yada. We know all that part. She gets to the bottom of her first paragraph, managing to say, "Let me be very clear, Roy Moore is a wretched, disgusting, pedophilic rapist who deserves absolutely no place in any leadership position." That's the first paragraph. And that's the truest thing that she will then say. So then, most would say the choice is clear. Vote for Doug Jones, the Democratic candidate running against him. Surely he doesn't have as terrible a history as Roy Moore. No, he doesn't, and don't call me Shirley. And they would be right. As of yet, Doug Jones has not been publicly accused of sexual assault. I love that "as of yet" part. Has not been removed from his post twice and has had generally favorable things to say about LGBT inclusiveness. Well, good for you, Doug Jones. In fact, as he is off to point out, he helped prosecute the KKK terrorists who in 1963 bombed a Birmingham church, leading to the death of four young girls. These are all wonderful qualities, even if, excluding the prosecution of the KKK, they are things we would expect most good people to have. So he's not special. He's just as good as we might expect any good person to be. Right? Except for the prosecuting the murderous Klansman part. Well, then the wheels, which were kind of wobbling before, begin to squeak and shriek and fall right off Alex's wagon. The problem with Doug Jones, she reveals through her privilege, is not when you point out what he hasn't done that Roy Moore has, but rather when you look at what Doug Jones says he plans to do, or, as is often the case, not do. At a time when the already abysmal American healthcare system is at threat of being outright gutted by Congress, Doug Jones has repeatedly shied away from supporting Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan, which was actually, in the beginning, John Conyers' Medicare for All plan, and has been John Conyers' Medicare for All plan, but John Conyers is gone now, and Bernie co-opted it long before John Conyers was gone, so now the only thing Alex knows is that Bernie invented the idea of Medicaid for All, or Medicare for All, back sometime around whenever it was that he formed the Earth into out of a formless void. Despite the fact that his very own website states that he believes health care is a right and not a privilege limited to the wealthy and those with jobs that provide coverage. So where does she get the idea that he doesn't support Medicare for All? Oh, that's right, she imagined it. And in a time when the college debt crisis is racking up in the trillions of dollars, he has not endorsed any sort of tuition-free college education program despite, and I know this is getting tiresome, his own website stating that providing a quality education to all children is the key to a long-term thriving economy. This is where the intellectual powers of our friend Alex here sort of fall apart. So, on the one hand, he says that providing a quality education to all children is key to a long-term thriving economy. He says that. It's on his website. But he's not pure enough because he didn't make a knee toward Bernie. This is not to say that I am hostile to Bernie Sanders, for as anyone who has listened to this program for any extended period of time knows, I am not hostile to Bernie Sanders. I like Bernie Sanders. Voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary. I do not, however, am not, and it'll be hard to convince me ever, that Bernie Sanders is Almighty God, which Alex seems to think. If you don't specifically endorse Bernie Sanders' proposal as a Bernie Sanders proposal, then you're not really sincere when you say that healthcare is a right or that providing quality public education is the key to our economic future. No. And then comes this. Oh, she must have been proud of this. Coming up with this this phrase. As a short aside, looking at Doug Jones' campaign website is an enlightening look into the extent of his tiptoeing mediocrity. Really? Tiptoeing mediocrity? Wonder how long it took to come up with that. Clicking the priorities section immediately greets you with a phrase that thrusts into your face Jones' nauseating fetishization of respectability politics. Oh, dear God, there's another one of those buzzwords, like tribalism and virtue signaling, that infect our modern usage of the language, or ill usage of the language. Moving on from the meaningless blurb that is that sentiment, is the economy section of this page, which starts out with the very telling phrase, small businesses are truly the backbone of the American economy. This despite the fact that workers, not businesses, are the backbone of any economy. Boy, I tell you what, I should have given it a little more thought. I could have run the Red Army Choir singing the International behind this. Not that there's anything wrong with the Red Army Choir. It's just that, you know, that's really going to draw the voters in. That whole workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, the dictatorship of the proletariat stuff. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. American workers are continually laboring longer and harder for less and less pay. True. While the capitalists who own these businesses are making more and more is what Doug Jones feels is most important to state first in his campaign website's economy section. You know, that's just not true. One of the keys to providing counterpoint or argument against something else is to accurately reflect what the something else says. And she's saying here that he says something. He says that he's got sympathy for small business owners. I guess that's a terrible thing. Oh, but she's got a buzzword, and she's gonna gnaw on it, like a chihuahua with a chew toy. Going back to respectability politics, Doug Jones loves it a lot. God damn. You know, usually we have to find a real live, genuine, no kidding, honest to God wingnut to get this much stupid into this few words. It is difficult to hear Jones speak for more than 30 seconds without him mentioning bipartisanship or reaching across the aisle. Sister, did it ever occur to you that you can't elect the same sort of progressive or liberal that you can elect in Vermont, Massachusetts, California, Oregon, or Washington that you can in Alabama? Now, if you listen to the last 2 hours of this program, you heard Dr. Phillips repeatedly note that a lot of this premillennial dispensationalism, this baloney, this mumbo jumbo, this garbage theology is driven by fear. But in Alex's world, Doug Jones should show up in a little Chairman Mao hat with a little red star on it and give the people of Alabama a good talking to instead of getting in office and then trying to do what he can to effect positive change in the state of Alabama. Doug Jones is a lawyer. Doug Jones has far more experience and arguably, compared to this screed, far more talent in trying to convince people of the rightness of his position than Alex will apparently have if she lives to be a million. And he has to convince more than the Democratic Socialists of America, Alex's of the world, a lot more of them, in order to win the office. Okay? But that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. If you're a member of the, you know, Purity Brigade. Jones cares so much about respecting the other side of the issues that his campaign put out an ad that described the Civil War as two sides believing so strongly in their cause that they were willing to die for it, and citing the example of a Confederate and a Union general coming together as a virtuous act that should be encouraged. Well, I don't know how you're going to encourage too many Union generals and Confederate generals to come together, seeing as how the war was more than 150 years ago, and they're all kind of, you know, dead. really, really dead. And let's take a look at the phrase that enraged dear Alex here. Two sides believing so strongly in their cause that they were willing to die for it. You know what? No one takes a back seat to me in referring to the Confederacy as a great big nasty ball of hate-filled racist treason. But given that Mr. Jones is a talented crafter of arguments, and this has nothing to do with respectability politics, Bernie would have won. It has to do with being a talented practitioner of the art of word knowing. What he said was true. Two sides believing so strongly in their cause that they were willing to die for it. The same can be said in any war. The Napoleonic Wars. Waterloo. Two sides believing so strongly in the truth of their cause that they were willing to die for it. The Boer War. Two sides believing so strongly in their cause that they were willing to die for it. The Iran-Iraq War. Two sides believing so strongly in their cause that they were willing to die for it. World War II. World War I. The Mexican War? The Punic Wars? The Peloponnesian War? Every war in the history of the human species can be described in exactly those terms. So I'm kind of licked for figuring out what she thinks the point she was making was. Oh, but she's not done. Doug Jones is a terrible, horrible, awful human being who has not properly bent his knee and bowed in abject fealty to Bernie Sanders and must therefore be stopped. Want to guess which way Alex is going to vote? Do the Greens have themselves a little candidate in Alabama, or is she just going to stay home? One wonders. One must think hard about what exactly Jones is willing to compromise on if he sees shaking hands with a general who fought for the preservation of chattel slavery as even a possibility. Hey, you know what happened after the Civil War, Alex, you ahistorical twit? Confederate generals, at least one of them, became upstanding, oath-taking members of the Union Army. They swore an oath of re-allegiance to the country. The riot, you heard Dr. Phillips refer to the riot. The riot in New Orleans was put down or opposed by a Confederate general leading Union troops. A Confederate cavalry officer by the name of Joe Wheeler fought in the Spanish-American War in Cuba. I'm guessing somewhere along the way, there was some handshaking. But that kind of handshaking is absolutely intolerable to a politically pure moron like dear Alex. I got to give her points, though. She does at least refer to it as the Democratic Party of Alabama. this is a good thing. At least, you know, I would say. At least she's not using the Gingrich language of Democrat Party. And then her final pure paragraph of pure 200-proof Moranity. Come Election Day, Alabamians will have the sacred honor of participating in the democratic process. Really? Really, Alex? Voting's an honor, is it? You goddamn fool. An honor. Hoo-wee! Yeah, an honor. That's right. That's right, special, calling voting an honor, not a right. Nice to see the little privileged white girl thinks that voting is an honor as opposed to a right. Or maybe, as some have said, a sacred obligation. But she's not done. She's got some fat shaming to do because I guess Doug Jones isn't quite as fetching as Bernie Sanders is. Come Election Day, Alabamians will have the sacred honor of participating in the democratic process by voting for either a child rapist or a weak-kneed white blob in a suit to go work on Capitol Hill for some unknown corporate donor. Personally, I can't say that I will be taking part. What was that again? Weak-kneed white blob in a suit. Sister, you stand up in front of a jury. You prepare weeks of testimony. You prosecute Klansmen in Alabama. Then come back and tell us all about weak need. You know, she's just one fool out of God knows far too many. But this is an election. This is an election that is going to have national consequences. And this is an election that may be decided on the thinnest of margins. Over on Medium, you can support, you can evince your support for something by clapping for it. I don't know where they all came from, but 1,400 people have clapped for this miserable piece of claptrap. I can't say that I will be taking part. I wonder how many Alabamians similarly ill-educated, similarly ignorant, similarly foolhardy she has convinced with this piece of dreck to stay home. Because this is the kind of election, you know, when Al Franken, bless his heart, when Al Franken won his first election, it was by 340
40 votes after all the recounts and re-recounts and re-re-re-recounts were over with. Yeah. 340 votes. If out of that 1.4K, that 1,400 claps that she got on Medium, and my God, this thing's being retweeted and Facebooked and social media all over the place. She's going to be kind of a pariah if Doug Jones wins by, say, I mean, or if Roy Moore wins by, say, oh, 1,000 votes. Mm-hmm. But win or lose, this is a symptom of a larger problem that persists in our country. The willingness on the part of some to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Oh, if only Bernie had come down to run against Roy Moore, he would have really shown Roy something. Bernie couldn't even win the Alabama primary in 2016. Not only did he not win, he got his ass righteously handed to him. So, yeah, we have a problem. And Alex isn't the face of it, but she's part of it because she has clearly made it clear that she does not wish to be part of the solution. Because referring to a guy who put Klansmen in prison, he put two Klansmen in prison for the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. One of them has already died there, and another one eventually will. But in sweet, pure, dear, stupid Alex's world, he's a weak, need blob. And she cannot say that she'll be participating. You know, there used to be a saying among Southerners that there were three kinds of Yankees. There were Yankees, and those were people who just lived up north. There were damn Yankees, and those were people who lived up north and came down and visited and went back home. And then there were goddamn Yankees who came down south, decided they liked everything about it but the people who lived there, and stayed and went on to say things like, why do you people eat those grits? Why can't I get a decent New England boiled dinner here? That's one way of looking. I'm not saying she's a goddamn Yankee. She might be native born. Who cares? Once upon a time, I had a professor who described the three kinds of negligence, namely simple negligence, gross negligence, and willful, wanton, and reckless negligence, as the difference between you fool, simple negligence, you damned fool, gross negligence, and you goddamned fool, which is willful, wanton, and reckless negligence. Alex here, being how this is Moran Monday, falls under goddamn fool. So yeah, Moran.
Let's look at some of the places that people will be voting in Jefferson County, Alabama, tomorrow. This is part of what I mentioned to Dr. Phillips. Steve in chat is saying, I'm calling you out. Who do you think will win out tomorrow? That's tough. My heart says one thing and my brain says another. And there's a deep conflict, but in those conflicts, most often, my brain tends to win. My heart wants desperately to believe that there are enough decent people in Alabama to keep Roy Moore out of the Senate. If I were a Republican, and that's a filthy thing to say in its own right. If I were a Republican, I would like to think that I would take a look at the situation and say, hey, you know, if we get him now, we're probably stuck with him until he dies. So I think what I'll do is I'll sit this one out or write somebody in, or hell, maybe I'll vote for the Democrat and then throw his ass out in 2020. When maybe we'll have a better candidate like Big Luther Strange or Mo Brooks, Less Brains. Both of whom care every bit as much about the precious little fetuses as Roy Moore does. And may actually be more effective. If I was a Republican, I might say, hey, you know what? Toyota and Mazda are both looking at building humongous multi-million dollar plants in Alabama. I sure wouldn't want people to start writing to Mazda, at Mazda USA or whatever the Toyota Twitter feed is, saying, if Roy Moore is elected and you build a plant in Alabama, I will never, ever, 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 ever buy another one of your automobiles. I wouldn't want that to happen if I was a Republican in Alabama. That's what I like to think if I was a Republican. Of course, if I was a Republican, I wouldn't be sitting here saying we've got $100 left to go in fundraising for this program tonight. I would be well-funded by the Heritage Foundation, the Competitive Institute, Enterprise Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and wallowing in money. Look what sticking his nose up their ass did for Rush Limbaugh. Well, you know, opioid problem notwithstanding. Yeah. And we do. Thank you very kindly to Renee. Thank you, Renee, very, very much for jumping in. We got $100 to go in fundraising for the evening now. That's huge. That is tremendous indeed. Note coming in from our buddy Todd in South Carolina, Stan. Subject line, Alabama election. Bob, this Mobile Marauder election is like another one of your one-question IQ tests. It is that. Although, you might argue that this is a two-question IQ test. Question one, will you go and vote? Question two, will you get it right? Will you get question... Because you got to get question one and question two right in order not to be a moron in this particular scenario. Hi, Todd. Charlie says, Bob, I was raised in the Church of Christ. I never saw a musical instrument in the church. Of course not. Not so much as a kazoo or a freaking triangle. The Church of Christ does not believe in premillennialism. The church does not believe that the Zionist Jews are right because of their treatment of the Palestinian Arabs. We believe that Zionist Judaism is evil. The Church of Christ does not follow the Old Testament, but only the New Testament. We believe that Jews must do the same thing that Gentiles must do for salvation. We do not follow the beliefs of speaking in tongues, miracle healings, and so on. On the other hand, even though Charlie says they don't follow the Old Testament, they do, because they don't like your Homer sectionals and all of that. And they,
and I'm not talking about the United Churches of Christ. I'm talking about the We Ain't Got a Piano Church of Christ. They cite an Old Testament verse as their reason for not having musical instruments. Sing and make melody in thy heart, it says in Psalms. I know this because I remember when Church of Christ people would explain to little Baptists like me why we were going to hell because we weren't Church of Christ. So can you tell how thoroughly I am evading Steve's question? My heart wants to think that there are enough Alabamians to get the job done and do the right thing and protect what tattered remnants of the reputation of that state exist. My brain says otherwise. I will go with my brain. And then, once Roy Moore has won, I will get to sit back and watch as none of the shit that has been predicted about how the Republicans will have a problem on their hands with Roy Moore in the Senate come to fruition. I won't giggle, but I will have some smug satisfaction when chinless Mitch McConnell, Mitch McTurtle, stands up in the well of the Senate and says, the people of Alabama have spoken. And that's the end of the problems with Roy Moore. And if it should happen that, say, Kirsten Gillibrand or Kamala Harris go up and tell him that they will never speak to him again, or ever, at all, no way, no sir, no how, and he calls them Jezebels and tells them to go make him a sandwich, well, I'll at least know that I was right in that regard, too. It's wicked, it's evil, it's nasty, but it's also, I'd say, 9-to-1 likely. The number, 1/3 to 1/2 of voting precincts being churches in Alabama, that works to Moore's favor. Can you imagine being a person of color and having to walk into a Southern Baptist church to vote? That would require a level of courage that I don't think we can say many of us would have. And it's a damn long stretch to think that anybody else would either. So there's my prediction. I don't want it to be true. I desperately don't want it to be true. But I fear it will be. And you know what? By this time tomorrow night, we may very well know. How interesting. So there's the program for this evening. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed participating and creating it for you. Thanks to Sister Carol Baker for hooking me back up with Dr. Michael Phillips for that fascinating conversation in the first part of the program. Thank you very much, Carol. Thanks to all of you who keep the program going. Thank you so very much. This program does not exist without you. And hopefully, although we've reached that part of the month where the overnight crew is, I mean, this is the part of the month where we really, really, really need subscribers. That'll probably come down from $100 to maybe, you know, 80, maybe 60. So we'll have 200 plus whatever the leftover was when we next talk again tomorrow evening. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to Steve. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox and Ben Birch. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.